Welcome, warrior. You are listening to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Assault Group Book Review Podcast. Your hosts, Jorn Vestai Vampyr and Jajim Tai Jajim, will explore Klingon culture as it appears in Star Trek literature. Perhaps you yourself can hear the cry of your inner warrior. If so, go to www.kag.org and make your presence known. Learn how to join the Klingon Assault Group and begin your journey along the way of the warrior. Now, here are your hosts, Kapla. Greetings and welcome to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Book Review Podcast. I am one of your hosts, Jajim.
I am Jorn.
And today we are going to be looking at Treaty's Law, Part 4 of the Day of Honor series written by Dean Wesley Smith and Christine Catherine Rush, published in October 1997.
This is actually the book that sets down the incidents that brought the Day of Honor into fruition as an actual Klingon holiday.
You want to give us a brief summary of the plot there, John?
From the back of the book, the Day of Honor is celebrated throughout the Klingon Empire. But every tradition had to begin somewhere. Cygna Beta is an M-class planet, ideal for farming. The Federation wants Cygna Beta, but the Klingon Empire has a stronger claim. Kirk hates to lose the planet, especially to his old adversary, Commander Kor. Their mutual antagonism turns into an uneasy alliance. However, when yet another alien fleet attacks both the Klingons and the USS Enterprise. Now Kirk and Kor must rely on each other's honor, or none of them may survive to wage their war again. Frankly, this description on the back of the book is got to be the furthest from any description of what's going on. We're going to get into what goes on in the story, but the Enterprise gets there before Kor does. And when the Enterprise gets there, according to the Organian Treaty, the planet has already been awarded to the Klingon Empire. So whatever the Federation does through the course of this adventure is not going to affect who's got a claim on the planet. And I don't know. We'll get into all these stuff as we go along. It's just, if you read the back of the book for this particular novel, it's not telling you anything about what's going on.
No. I got to wonder who writes the blurbs for the back of the books, if they even read the book when they write it, or if they just go by some outline or something. It just seems like sometimes they're just not even close.
It couldn't have been the editor. The editor would have at least read the manuscript. No, it's got to be somebody somewhere in marketing that says, oh, Kirk, oh, Kor, oh, they'll fight again. Hey, go team.
Yeah. And as you say, nothing could be farther from the truth or part of this story. So what were your overall impressions?
This is book four of the series. As such, it's a self-contained story and can be read without referencing the other volumes. But to me, it appears better than average, better than the rest of the books in the story, because it ties all the events up that lead to what's going to go on in the Day of Honor. It brings together characters who can define what honor means in either society, either Klingon society or Federation society, and gives those characters a chance to look at each other's way of expressing their honor and what they hold dear, and sets up a situation where Klingons learn more about honor and decide they're going to respect that honor throughout the rest of their history.
Yes, and they make some interesting discoveries. I really enjoyed the book. The overall frame of the story is set somewhat as a story within a story. Kurdok, a Klingon, an aging farmer on this planet, is telling children about the events that led up to the Day of Honor. And this is set, it's set through or bracketed by a prologue and an epilogue. But as the story goes on, you kind of forget about that because it's very much the story between Kirk Kor and Kurdok really moves along and it stays interesting. I might have liked to have seen, though, an interruption every now and then with him telling the story to the children, maybe the children even asking questions to remind us that we were reading a story within a story. Now, as we know, Klingons have a tendency to embellish stories, but I didn't see a whole lot of embellishment within this one.
No, another thing that's nice about this particular story is you're getting to see a side of the Klingon Empire you normally don't. How do farmers or the working class express their honor, have honor, and excel at honorable activities?
Yeah, and that's a side of the Klingon society we don't see a great deal of throughout all of Star Trek. We don't see a lot of what goes on behind the scenes with farming, manufacturing, shipbuilding, all those things. We just see the warriors mostly, but we're getting a little glimpse into the behind the scenes of what Klingons do when they aren't warriors. But at the same time, they still are warriors. They're just fighting a different kind of battle as opposed to fighting enemies. Now, speaking of action in this book, there wasn't ever a dull moment as far as I was concerned. However, I did feel that the story with the antagonist, the Nar, who were attacking the planet apparently for no reason whatsoever, it was a long time before we got the reveal as to exactly why they were attacking. And I thought that might have been held back maybe a little too long for me. I found myself becoming confused. It's like, well, why are they doing this? But, you know, it did finally come out, and I guess the timing was okay, but I would have liked to have gotten a little more information on the Nar and their reasons for attacking earlier.
No. I think that when they revealed why the Nar was attacking was in the right place. Having the Nar as the ubiquitous enemy, you don't know why they're doing this. You only know that they are doing this. You don't know their motivations. You only know you have to stop them.
Okay. So we can talk about some of the characters. We had Kirk and Spock and Sulu and Scotty. Plus we had a new character, Vivian Rathbone. She had quite a learning curve going on with her throughout this story.
Which is interesting because she was brought on the mission because she was the expert on this planet, in that Dr. Rathbone was involved in the Terran effort, the Federation effort, to try and make this planet productive, to compete with the Klingon farmers to see who is going to be able to keep the planet for their particular empire. The terrain, she knew the conditions, she was their expert.
Yes, and you know, as a scientist, she found herself thrown into a situation where there were some battles to be fought, and I think her best part of this story was that she learned a lot about herself and what she was capable of doing when she needed to do it.
Oftentimes it's important to push your character into an uncomfortable situation so that the character may grow.
Yeah, and she did grow throughout this entire story. We also had another starship captain, Captain Bogle, from the Farragut, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, it's the Farragut, which is interesting because there's actually a fan film series for Star Trek on the USS Farragut, but Bogle is not the captain in that particular series.
You know, I liked his character a lot, and I would have liked to have seen a little more. But the real star of the show from the Farragut was his engineer, Projeff, who he and Scotty worked out a whole bunch of stuff together. They worked it out together, but they treated it as a friendly competition to see who could get to the end first.
They had been friends long before this adventure had ever occurred. So this type of a relationship was just the way these two characters would work with each other. Hey, I got this idea. Yeah, I had it 5 minutes before you did.
they were a lot of fun together. I wouldn't call them comic relief, but their banter sure helped to lighten the story up a lot. And then we had everybody's favorite Dahar master, Kor. And you know what? With Kor, he was almost, for a lot of this story, he was a background character. He spent a lot of time being injured and unconscious and not really able to function. And I was kind of disappointed about that. I would have liked to have seen him be more involved.
I think we should have expected Kor not to have gotten injured and Kor and Kirk to have butted heads more in their defense of the colony. Which is even more interesting is, I believe it's Kurdok, Kor's number one, who is down on the planet with him. They had to go out on a mission. He, Sulu, and Vivian Rathbone, and Kurdok also, who am I thinking of? The Klingon farmer.
Oh, that was Kurdok.
Oh, I'm sorry. Who is the number one then?
You know what? I'm embarrassed to say that I do not remember his name.
And I think the problem for that is that you don't remember his name because of the very situation I'm talking about. Kurdok, Sulu, Vivian Rathbone, and him went on a mission to delay the Gnar, and the terrain killed Kor's number one, whereas the weaker Federation members made it through to the end. Now, yeah, Vivian Rathbone knew the terrain. Kurdok, because he's a farmer, knew the terrain. But still, you would think a Klingon would have more endurance and manage to survive the perils of marching to the position they needed to get to.
Now, of course, first officer, well, everybody throughout this story was having a hard time with the climate of the planet, which very, very hot during the day, very much like a greenhouse during the day, and very, very cold at night. All of that put together, plus the battles that they had been fighting, I think that's what led to the demise of Kor's first officer. But you know, I'll tell you what, as far as Kor is concerned, I really like the way that Kor and Kirk knew that they had to set aside their differences. I mean, these two guys are itching to fight each other. They are itching to see who the best one is because, you know, the Organians shut them down before anything could happen. And they had to set all the animosity aside and work together in order to stop the Gnar from decimating the planet and basically killing off all the Klingons.
Yep.
So what about the Gnar? What were your impressions of the Gnar, the antagonists in this story?
For the most part, they were just the boogeyman.
Yeah. They were sending ships down to the planet. They were destroying the crops that the Klingons had planted. And they, you know, again, it's like, why are they doing this? It took a long time to get to that point to understand.
But the authors did give a clue when they pointed out that the Gnar were destroying the Klingon crops and sparing the natural vegetation of the planet.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. course, we find out as time goes on that the Nar had already claimed that planet. It had been their planet for a very long time before the Organians awarded the use of the planet to the Klingons. Now, this brings up what I think is a bit of a plot hole in this story. Why did the omnipotent Organians not realize that the planet, which the Klingons called Kwee-Tu, why did they not know that this planet belonged to somebody else?
I think the answer to this question is that the Organians are not omnipotent. The Organians are a higher being than most of the humanoids in the galaxy, that they're pure energy and thought and yada, yada, yada. But they are not omnipotent. They don't know everything. They're still observing what's going on, and they're dealing with the problem that is directly before them. Not the things that necessarily would have led up to it, or the things afterwards. It's like when they stop the Federation-Klingon War, they just stop the fighting. They don't address any of the conditions that led up to it or anything else. They just deal with the problem that's directly in front of them.
But at the same time, you know, I remember the Organian, his speech when he stopped both fleets in mid-flight, and he told Kirk and Kor, "I am standing on the homeworld of the Klingons, and I am standing on the homeworld of the Federation, and I am giving this edict saying, this is the way you're going to do this. There's going to be a neutral zone. You are not going to fight each other. And if you do fight each other, then you both will be destroyed." Now, if that does not indicate a very, very powerful race, all through the books that we have read, when the Organians come up, they don't seem to be as smart as the original series episode made them out to be.
That's the problem with semi or partially omnipotent beings. How do you deal with them? Throughout the run of Superman, he has had that problem. He starts out being able to leap tall buildings in a single bound. Then he learns to fly. Then his powers become very great, become super, become unbeatable. And DC has to roll them back to make the stories interesting. And then they become, you know, it's a roller coaster ride of where the character is when the character becomes so much greater than the other characters that inhabit that particular universe. But still, I think the Organians, as a race, just deal with the problems that are in front of them. When they say that the Klingons and the Federation will in the future become friends, that can just be a natural conclusion, because a lot of races, given exposure to each other over a long period of time, are either going to become friends or one of them's going to kill off the other.
Yeah. So, well, the Organians, I think we can come to the conclusion that they aren't as powerful as they are perceived to be originally. So we have the planet itself, Kwee-Tu, or what did we call it? Sigma, what was it?
It's actually Kwee-Tu, because it was awarded to the Klingons. Sigma Beta doesn't matter, because that's the Federation name. That doesn't count.
Okay, so this planet is brutal. Why anybody would want it, I'll never know.
Well, they actually explain that. Why do the Klingons want it? The Klingons need more food. They need more food production. They need more land that they can cultivate. And this planet is ideal for growing food. The Klingons are adaptable enough as a species to survive on this planet. So it doesn't bother them as much as it bothers the Federation. But food is the main driving force for the Klingons to want this planet.
So why would the Federation be vying, or have been vying, for control over this place when it is described as more or less nothing but a hellhole? It's just way too hot. Everybody's miserable. I mean, constantly, McCoy was constantly drink water, drink water, drink water. And water was a very, very important part of this entire story, staying hydrated.
2 points here. One, why did the Federation want it? Because the Klingons want it. And by God, we are not going to let them have anything that they want.
Okay, I'll go along with that.
And two, the person who should have been telling everybody to drink water is not Bones, but should have been Dr. Rathbone, as she knew the planet and she knew how the Federation survived on this planet to try and make a go of it, to try and make it a better place.
Yeah, she should have been, well, yeah, if she was a planetary expert, she should have gone in knowing what the problems were going to be.
And how to solve them.
Mm-hmm. So there is a point you brought up in our notes about disruptor cannons, but something else that's missing.
Why are there cannons that can fire into the sky and take down ships and no defense satellites around the planet?
Yeah, now that's a good question. They wound up calling for help. They put out a distress call. Kirk came along right away, followed closely behind by the Farragut, and we had nothing to warn the people on the planet, Kurdok and his people, nothing to warn him that there was this impending danger. It just all of a sudden started.
I believe literally blasting the field that he was working in.
Mm-hmm. And just, you know, all their work was destroyed, and there was no warning. It just happened.
Now, they could have handled the satellite problem with like a line that the NAR came in, blasted all the satellites from orbit, and then the attacks began.
Well, the NAR, they absolutely had the capability to do most anything they want, because they had their three ships as opposed to the two Federation ships and three Klingon ships. And the ships in orbit were getting the snot beat out of them for most of this book.
Well, remember, the NAR kept adding ships to their fleet also.
Yeah, they had reinforcements come in too.
I believe they had two ships that were carrier class that were launching the smaller ships that went down and devastated the planet, and then another three or more ships in orbit to protect the two ships that were launching the strike ships and keeping the Klingon and Federation ships from getting close enough to the planet to help the people on the planet.
Yeah. One thing I found was interesting was the battle armor that the NAR wore. It was it needed anti-gravity tech to work. So if the anti-gravity devices in their suits broke down, it would basically crush them in their suits. We had one of the NAR soldiers was shot down, and Sulu and Rathbone actually got to talk to this person, who seemed to be a very reasonable person, which added more to the mystery of why the NAR were attacking. You know, they seemed to be just very reasonable.
Which, of course, is going to lead to the ending of the book when they negotiate a treaty between the NAR and the Klingons.
Yeah. Now, doesn't it seem a little strange that they would be wearing armor so heavy that they needed anti-gravity technology in order to just be able to stand up?
It would depend on their technology and how they were able to produce materials that could withstand the rigors of space. We can make very light steel. We can make aluminum. If the NAR can't, if their steel-like material is much denser, is, say, depleted uranium-based, then it's going to be incredibly heavy.
Yeah, it was. Well, the soldier that Sulu and Rathbone talked to, his legs had been crushed under the weight of that armor when the anti-grav unit went down.
But you see, that's an important thing to have between different alien races. They're not going to solve the problems the same way. The thing is, you've got Federation, you've got Klingons, you've got Romulans, and they've all got basically the same materials. Here you got the NAR, and they've got a different class of materials involving a different type of technological structure to their existence.
Yeah, so I wonder exactly where they are from in the galaxy and how far their home is from this planet.
Well, they're obviously from Narnia. You go through the wardrobe, and there you are.
Narnia. Okay. Oh, gosh. Oh, I suppose they have talking lions running around too, huh? That sound like Liam Neeson.
Well, at least they have talking lines that go through the story.
Oh, yes, there you go. So anyway, the adventures in this book, would you like to discuss that for a little bit?
This book, off running, stops running maybe for a page or two, but there is attack after attack after attack. The colony has four disruptor banks to try and repel these attacks. But in the first attack, two of them are taken out. And then later on, the third one is taken out. So they're left with one disruptor bank to try and take them down. You've got Spock up on the Enterprise trying to reduce the number of ships coming down to make these attacks so that it's easier for Kirk and Sulu to repel the invaders. But he's kept away because the NAR have established an orbit for their carrier-class ships closer to the planet than the Enterprise or the Klingons are able to get to. And then the NAR finally say, to heck with it, they're going to launch a ground-based invasion, and basically that's going to overwhelm the colony unless something can be done. They try to do stuff. It just keeps moving. As a story, there's really no let up. It's one of those that if you've got the time, you can sit there and read the whole book. It may take you a day or two, but you will sit there and read the whole book.
Oh yeah. There's no putting it down unless you absolutely have to, because it just is constantly moving forward, getting more and more complicated for Kirk and Kor and the farmers led by Kurdok. More people are getting injured and killed, and there's a lot at stake here. But the concept of how the Day of Honor comes to be in this through the whole thing, which is a really, really neat story.
Klingons know they have honor. Klingons see that the Federation can take honorable actions. They may not be driven by the same set of principles that the Klingons are driven to their honor, but the Federation has honor, and they live honor. The NAR have honor, and they live up to their honor, even though it matches neither the Federation nor the Klingon Empire. But they see every species has a variation of honor up to it.
And that is really basically the main story throughout this, even though we've talked about battles, we've talked about the Organians, we've talked about everything going forward through this book, the action and everything, but it is Kurdok that this story is actually about, and how he discovers that, yes, Klingons are honorable. Humans are honorable. Even the Gnar are honorable, as they show at the end when they come to the agreement, which we'll talk about in a little bit. But Kurdok actually admires Kirk and gains a deep respect for Kirk because of the honor that he shows by coming in to the camp of an enemy and fighting just as hard as they do to help them survive, simply because he received a distress call. Kirk was willing to set aside everything, all of his animosity against Klingons, at a time where tensions were running very high between the Empire and the Federation, and Kirk let that go and fought like a Klingon right next to the Klingons. We listed in our notes some concepts to look at. Let's talk about those for a bit.
The Klingons that are living on this planet don't understand that non-Klingons could have their own brand of honor. Basically, at this point in time, when the story starts, they're thinking there is only one brand of honor, the Klingon brand of honor. And Kurdok is thinking to himself early on that because he's no longer a warrior, he doesn't have the same honor that he had when he was a warrior, despite the fact that he is working just as hard to be a farmer to support those warriors to keep the defense force active.
And even though Kurdok is a simple farmer, he shows that he can also pick up a weapon and be quite a formidable warrior on his own.
Well, with Kurdok's case, my reading of the book at one point said that he had been a warrior and that he retired from that. But look at the other farmers. All of them were able to pick up a weapon to defend their homeland.
So, you know, that to me would suggest that all Klingons are trained in battle and then choose to go their own way, while some decide to be warriors for the Empire. The others choose to be farmers. They choose to be lawyers. They choose to be artists and pursue those concepts. But when it comes right down to it, all Klingons are warriors.
If you've seen the Klingon Christmas Carol, it's based on the fact that every Klingon is supposed to go through the second rite of ascension. The play itself is based on the fact that the main character, Scrooge, has not gone through his rite of ascension, and he's haunted to the point where he decides he needs to go through his rite of ascension. But all Klingons are there, therefore all Klingons have stated at one point they are a warrior.
Okay, this is a point that should be brought up in more series and more books, and not just focusing on the war warriors, but all the warriors of the Klingon Empire.
Yeah.
Okay, you also have listed here, who has the rights to a found planet?
Yeah, we've got the Organian Treaty that's going to roll between the Klingons and the humans. But the Gnar were on the planet decades, hundreds of years before either one of them were there. The question becomes, and this is not a question they looked at, but the question becomes, if you go to a planet and you set up a terraforming system, because you know, basically that's what the Gnar did when they seeded the planet. They were terraforming it for them. And then you leave the planet, and nobody sees that you're there for decades. Do you still have rights to it?
Well, that, I guess, depends on your point of view. From the Gnar point of view, obviously, it is their planet. The Klingons.
Because they did the work to get it started. Yeah. In their point of view, it is. But if you're going to have a, if you're going to see different races of aliens working together, there needs to be some sort of common definitions as to how you play together.
Yeah. Well, I think that if I were the Gnar, I would say, okay, we've seeded this planet. Now we're going to go away and we're going to let it settle and get the way we want it to be so we can come and do our thing with it. And we're going to leave a satellite in orbit to let everybody know that this is our planet.
They've got a claim on it. Yeah.
Yeah.
That would have been the easy solution. But here's the problem.
Uh-huh.
If they're gone for hundreds of years, will that satellite still be there? Will anybody be able to understand the satellite? Will even the Gnar be able to understand the satellite? Look at Egyptian hieroglyphics. What did it take for today's to be able to read the hieroglyphics?
It took the discovery of the Rosetta Stone.
Which was the same statement, was written in three different languages, the last of which still existed at the time of the finding.
Yes. And otherwise, we probably wouldn't know what the Egyptians were talking about.
One of the ways of looking at it is a query that I used to post to my students. What type of placard, what type of warning statement would you put on Yucca Mountain to warn future inhabitants of Earth of its danger? Now remember, Yucca Mountain is going to be dangerous to humans from radioactivity for 100,000 years. So your warning device has to last that long, has to be meaningful for that long.
Hmm. Good point. So I thought one of the interesting concepts in this book were the different types of battles that we had. We had the farmers fighting the environment to raise the crops, the Federation and Klingons fighting their animosity toward each other in order to cooperate to save the planet, Rathbone fighting her own doubts, which she was very full of, and constantly having to overcome that, Scotty and Projeff always fighting time, as engineers in Starfleet seem to be doing, and everyone fighting the effects of the heat, the environment on the planet itself.
And you didn't even talk about the fact that you have space battles between capital ships. You have capital ships battling with fighter ships that are going down to attack the planet. You have the fighter ships going down to attack the planet being fought off by ground forces. And then you have ground forces attacking ground forces. So you have, militarily, you have all kinds of different battles going on also, which probably emphasizes the different internal fights that you just listed off.
Yes. Well, and that's what I meant by the several different types of battles outside of the obvious, the fighting battles, especially battles that they had within themselves, and the ones that weren't quite as obvious or seen as battles. There's all these different conflicts going on all at the same time. Now, this is a very complex book that is not very long, but there is a lot of stuff in here that a person can get out of it by reading and just thinking about it.
And I think there's a lot of points that we've already been bringing up where they could have been explored more if the authors had the time to actually look into these details. But this book was designed to set up the Day of Honor holiday celebration for the Klingons and is just a relating of the events that lead up to that.
Yes. So, your favorite point of plot?
looking into the mindset of Klingons that do not engage in Defense Force activities, seeing how average Klingons exist and serve Pyre. Just a basic look of something in the Klingon society beyond the warrior.
Yeah, that's not something we get very often in Star Trek, unfortunately. So yeah, I kind of like Kurdok's realization that not all enemies are without honor, that their enemies do have honor. They may have their own brand of honor, but they also have honor overall that everyone can respect. It's as he said at the end of the book, "Today I tell this story to remind us all to honor those who fight and those who die in battle. Let this day of honor be remembered always."
Which, you know, since this becomes a Klingon ceremony, a Klingon special day for Klingons, there's a whole litany of procedures, of ways you're supposed to act during the day of honor, which will be discussed in the next book. How does the Day of Honor move from just a holiday for this planet, this community of Klingons, to become a Klingon holiday for all of the Klingon Empire? We see at the end of the book, Kurdok is making a point to keep it active within his community. Maybe if they'd had Kor's ship doing some activities, we might have seen that the remembrance of these events was spreading to the rest of the Klingon Empire.
Well, of course, you know, they're going to, we Klingons, we love to tell stories. We love to tell epic stories. And I can imagine Kor going back and telling stories about this and bringing about a day of honor in order to honor all warriors, no matter what they do.
So it might have been a good idea to either have Kor telling this story on Kronos, or Kurdok having made a journey, a pilgrimage, to, say, Boroth, and telling this story instead of just doing it within one of their huts.
Yeah, but then again, you know, that's how stories start, is very simply. And I think that was kind of a neat idea, that the Day of Honor was started by a farmer.
Yeah, I have to agree with that. Most of your most important holidays need to be started by your non-elite class of people within society for that event to take hold and last year after year after century after century.
Yes. Now, the book ends with, closes out with a compromise between the Nar and the Klingons and the Federation, with Captain Kirk, the Federation mediating between the two. And the solution is so simple that it's amazing. So Kirk works it out. So the Klingons get to stay on the planet as residents there. They can grow their crops. They can cultivate food for the Nar also, in return for being allowed to use the planet to grow food for the Klingon Empire. It is so simple and so elegant, and it took all of this conflict to get there.
Well, see, now that's where I have a problem, and I had a problem with that solution. Would Klingons pay tribute to another race? That is what they're doing.
Well, it seemed to me more like they were paying the rent.
Well, technically speaking, paying the rent is paying tribute to your landlord.
That's true. But, you know, I don't know. I thought it was a good solution. It was a simple solution. It was an obvious solution. And
it was a human solution.
Well, that's true. but it also ended the book. And of course, now, as we've been discussing for nearly an hour now, that wasn't the point of the story. The point of the story was to establish the Day of Honor and how that happened, which I think the book did very effectively.
Yes, I have to agree with that. It's just minor points that we're quibbling over.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And that's always fun. So we have the themes, the meaning of honor, which we've talked about. We've talked about cooperation, Kirk answering a distress call from the enemy and willing to fight along beside the Klingons. And you also mention, don't forget Boggle or Bogle, whatever his name is, who or however it's pronounced, and the Farragut coming to the rescue eventually.
Farragut had some more repairs it had to make before leaving the starbase, but the captain had no question about following Kirk to answer this distress call.
Mm-hmm. So how would you rate this book, John?
Probably right there at the top. I mean, we're looking at probably giving it about 5 stars out of.
Yeah, I think I'd give it 5 disruptor cannons.
No, don't do that. 4 of them will get blown away.
We don't want that to happen. You have any other thoughts about this book?
I don't know. It's kind of tough to say. It does bring up a few questions that it doesn't answer, but these are questions that this book wasn't set out to answer. But there are questions nonetheless. The Organians have set down a treaty between the Federation and the Klingons. How is the rest of the galaxy supposed to act under that treaty? What rights do people have towards the occupation and terraforming of a planet to meet their needs within the community of races in the galaxy? For instance, if the Tholians terraformed a planet, made it habitable for Tholians, it would be absolutely uninhabitable for any other race. Who gets the claim? And I'm glad we're going to see more on Day of Honor festivities in the next book in this series.
Yes, we are. We are going to look at next, we're going to look at the novelization of the Voyager episode, Day of Honor, written by Michael Jan Friedman. And that's a novelization of that. And then also what rounds out this entire series of books is a story called Honor Bound, which is a short story that finishes the collection. And we're going to do both of those in one show next time.
Because like you mentioned, Day of Honor is a novelization. You guys have probably already watched the episode, so we'll have to see what we can talk about. More importantly, go back and watch the episode again, read the novel again, see what pieces of the description of the Day of Honor festivities you might be able to pull out to reenact, to recreate at the conventions you go to. Honor Bound is a illustrated short story and won't take very long to talk about.
So that'll be next time. So you can listen to our podcast at CAG.org/podcast. You can also find us on Apple Podcasts. And we'd love to have you listen. We'd love to get your feedback. Yeah, please let us know what you think about the show. So for Bound by Honor, I am Jim.
I need to point out the irony in your last statement.
Go for it.
They're listening to this podcast, and you're telling them how to listen to this podcast.
They all do that, though.
There's irony in every podcast.
There is, indeed. Okay. So, as I was saying,
I am Jorn.
I am Jajim. Kapla.
And for Bound by Honor, Kapla.
You have been listening to Bound by Honor, the Klingon Assault Group Book Review Podcast. Bound by Honor is brought to you by the Klingon Assault Group and is produced by Admiral Kirk Zantai Loon Keech. If you hear the call of the warrior, visit our homepage at www.kag.org to learn more about what it means to be Klingon. Perhaps you have what it takes to be one of us. Listener feedback is always welcome at podcast@kag.org. Kaplop!